Hard work beats talent when talent doesn't work hard. That's why when it comes to hard work, nothing works harder than a Chevy Silverado. No wonder Chevy Silverado is the official truck partner of the Chicago Bears. Check out a new Silverado at ChevyDriveChicago.com.
Thank you, Kim Gordon. Steve Bertrand here. You're listening to the Business Lunch on the Thursday afternoon, 720 WGN. Another beautiful day in Chicago, just like all of them. We had a little theme music coming in, some Latin sound, and so for that, we will welcome Ozzy Godoy and Chef Rodolfo Cuadros of Carnival on the Near West Side into the studio. Welcome to you both, gentlemen.
Good afternoon.
All right, great to be here.
Ozzy, let's start with you, the general manager. So, you know, I started by saying, when I met you earlier today, I said, oh, perfect billboard. You know, you drive down the Kennedy Expressway, you see this big, colorful sign. You were sort of the pioneer in that whole restaurant district.
Yeah, you know, we have a great dynamic ownership that really saw the potential of that area and really utilizing it, you know, before it became what it is right now. I mean, you know, the West Loop and the Near West Side has just exploded. And yeah, we have the benefit of having the best billboard within our own building that we are the most noted, noticed building in the city.
I want to talk to you more about that a little bit later after we go to Cuba for a bit. But I would imagine one of the challenges then is if you're in a new hot area and you're seen as the old guy in the hot area, it might be more of a challenge to get some traffic into you.
You know, for us, it isn't because, And I say this honestly, you know, along with Rodolfo, dynamic leadership, as well as also our ownership, we just keep getting better. You know, we don't reinvent ourselves. We make sure we introduce ourselves to the area, but we're the trailblazers. And, you know, with the competition, it brings more people and it really signifies how great we are.
Let's talk Cuba. You guys are emphasizing Cuba over the next few days.
Yes, we are. I'll let Rodolfo speak more about it. But, we are really, really celebrating what Cuba and what his trip and how it really speaks to our food this week.
And so what strikes me is, you know, when we talk about the U.S. and Cuba sort of normalizing things and Cuba opening up to the U.S., we think of what it's going to mean for Cuba, you know, there are a lot more Americans going there and things like that. But it also is going to introduce a lot of us to a lot of Cuba that we might have overlooked or forgotten, right? It comes back to the forefront. So that's what you guys are doing.
Exactly. Absolutely.
Our Rodolfo just got back from a trip to Cuba, right? Come on up to the microphone.
Yeah, we were out there for about 2 weeks, we went to Santiago and Baracoa, which is like in the Guantanamo part of Cuba, and, you know, looking at a lot of the indigenous food around that area.
Your fourth time there?
Yeah, I've been to other places. I've been to Havana and a couple of towns in the outskirts of Havana, but this one we were looking more at the southern part of the island and their style of eating and food.
When was the first time you were there?
So the first time I went there was probably 2005.
Okay, so 11 years, 10, 11 years.
Yeah, it's changed quite a bit.
Tell me about that. How has it changed?
The first time I went there, it was, you know, obviously Americans weren't allowed, but I went through Canada, and we went to Havana. It was still very closed off. Definitely very, very little bit of American influence is changing a lot now. And, you know, it was a unique experience. The food wasn't great. It's changing now for sure.
Right. Food is better.
Yeah. Well, you know, outside influence brings more quality produce and everything.
Well, okay, so the food quality is better than what they're eating, but I would imagine the recipes haven't changed.
No, not much.
Just the ingredients that they're using for those recipes.
For sure. Well, the quality has improved, but they definitely have, they brought the culture along for a long time, and they stay very true to it.
So you're down there with a group of other chefs and restaurant people,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, about 7 chefs and 4 restaurant people were there.
I can just imagine that. Must have been a great time sitting around some of the tables.
For sure. It's a big dinner. You know, you go to paladares, which are people's homes that they're literally cooking there for you. It's their version of restaurants here.
So the paladares?
Okay. Paladares, yeah.
And that's basically a restaurant. They're just working it out of their own house.
Yeah, so the individuals pay some sort of stipend to the government and some sort of taxes in order for them to be able to serve customers out of their home. So they cook for you, just like it's more like a family style dinner.
And so then what do you as a chef down there with other chefs eating and observing, what do you bring back to the people you're going to cook for.
So we're looking more of the concept and the unique flavors that they bring. Obviously, we're blessed to live in a country where we can get the highest quality of anything through the world. So we're looking at the flavors, the concept, the way they present things, the soul of the food, basically trying to translate it into what we do.
Do you try to, when you take a foreign recipe, an indigenous recipe from Cuba or wherever, do you try to duplicate it in the U.S. or do you try to imitate it but give it a little U.S. standard too? You know what I'm saying?
You always have to cater to our clientele. So, you know, it has to be visually appealing, but we still try to stay true to the indigenous flavors.
It's a bit of a challenge, isn't it?
It's a fun challenge to have. And I think, you know, every chef goes through and every chef thinks about that. Because, you know, if you travel to Southeast Asia or Thailand or wherever it is, you're trying to translate, you know, their indigenous food here with our ingredients and serve it in a way that people can enjoy it here.
What's the best thing that you ate there that you are going to bring back here, that you brought back here?
So right now we're featuring for this week branzino, which is done with enchilado, coconut enchilado sauce. The part that we went to in Cuba, they cooked a lot with coconut, which is something that doesn't, you know, that a lot of people aren't familiar with. You know, mm-hmm. You just think Cuban, like rice, bean, and pork.
Right, right.
So this part of Cuba was a lot of seafood. So this is a very seafood-driven dish. And you have yuca, which is a root vegetable. We're showing it with a little bit of like a lime juice, a vinaigrette, and then chilada sauce, which is peppers, chilies, achote, which is a native seed that gives it a really earthy flavor, and coconut. So we're featuring that dish and a couple of cocktails through this week that we learned along our travels there.
All right, Ozzy. So Rodolfo cooks the food. How do you, as a businessman, capitalize on the buzz around Cuba to bring people in?
You know, it's really tying in the message. And as I said, you know, it's really translating his passion, you know, of really incorporating those things that he's really gained from different parts of Cuba. And it's really servicing it properly, getting the information out, using our marketing director as well, our team, and just really preaching it to our guests. You know, we're about an experiential experience for our guests, and it's tying that whole thing of, you know, getting the message out, but once they're in, introducing them, showing them what our food's about and what we're celebrating. And that's, I think that's one thing that we've gotten really, really almost experts on for our clientele and for people that are new to Carnival. We've really done that a lot more in this past couple of years.
The restaurant is Carnival. How do people find it?
Oh, they find it amazing. I mean, you know, if I had a dime for every time a guest walks in and, you know, their eyes open up. And, you know, we always say in Carnival that, you know, whatever can be happening outside in Chicago, you come to Carnival as an escape. And like I said, with the passionate food that Chef puts out there and then how our dynamic ownership has made such a great, 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 you know, site for us to serve in.
Right.
It really, really speaks a lot to how we serve and how we get it.
Well, gentlemen, it was great to meet you. I wish you continued success. Thanks for coming in.
Great to be here. Thank you.
You're listening to The Business Lunch on 720 WGN. You're listening to The Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Bill Geiger is Chicago's retirement planning advisor. And good thing, you know, Bill, welcome back to The Business Lunch. How are you?
Nice to be back, sir.
You look rested and restored and all
yes,
of that.
Yes, I am. Thank you.
So I was reading the Federal Reserve's 2015 report on, you know, people in preparation for retirement, all of
right,
that.
Right.
About half of the people responded that said that they're still working toward their retirement, less than confident that they are making good investment choices, which... You know, I think that's probably true for most of us, but there are ways to make good choices. I mean, it's available to us.
Well, the big deal is education. There's a lot of conventional wisdom that, Steve, that people are operating under that's not quite true. For instance, if you own enough different stocks, then you have a, quote, well-diversified portfolio.
Right.
One thing goes down, the rest of them go up and kind of smooths the road and you'll be fine, right? The problem with that is in 2008, if it had a stock in it, it went down 40-60%. Didn't matter what stock it was. Didn't matter how many you owned. Same thing in 2001 and 2002. So there's a lot of conventional wisdom that people are operating under that isn't quite true. It's a carryover from what we used to believe before. And I would challenge the 50% number, Steve. I have met with thousands folks in my career, literally, working on retirement planning. And I would say the number is closer to 80-90%, because even people who think they know what they're doing are operating under old rules that don't apply anymore.
I think there's two. There's some, it's maybe a fits and starts kind of thing where you get greatly enthused about it. You look into it, you set things the way you need to, and then, you know, time passes and you forget to check back in or update things, and you get passed by a little bit.
Yeah, the whole concept of everybody in America having to be a, in essence, a pension fund manager,
right,
because they have a 401k.
Now, right? Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, where did you get the training to do that? It's you know, here's a website, here's a couple brochures, have at it, and take care of your own retirement. It's kind
of
tough.
That same survey said, you know, of those of us who are working toward retirement, only 25% have the defined pension benefit.
Right.
75% of us are on our own.
And that number is going down every single day.
I think that's going to be huge one day. I think that is going to... That's what's going to cause the pitchforks on Constitution Avenue and Pennsylvania Avenue.
Well, imagine you're on your own managing your plan.
I don't have to imagine that, Bill.
Okay, but imagine the second part. You're 5 years away from retirement, and all of a sudden your 401k gets cut in half. It becomes a 201k. How do you retire?
Right.
That's going to change the rest of your life. And people, you know, the educational part of this is so critical, Steve, is a lot of folks are approaching this with way more risk in their portfolio than what they really should. More than what they know they have.
Okay, yeah.
So the concept is you need to have a game plan. You need to have a conceptual plan of how you're going to do this, which is not so easy to pick up from the popular press or from websites.
Okay, so one more statistic here from this report that I love. 40% of those saving for retirement with self-directed accounts, what we're talking about,
right.
Got advice from a broker, a lawyer, or financial planner. Pretty good, 40%.
Okay.
28% of these savers receive advice from friends or family. Not so good. 24% receive advice online or found in books.
Right.
Probably not so good. 11% get advice from their employers.
Yeah.
So.
The financial planner aspect in there is the most critical aspect. I mean, that's where you should really be getting your advice. Because you get it online, you get it from your lawyer, God forbid. What do they know about retirement advice? Or even your accountant. I mean, you really, you know, this may sound biased because this is the field that we're in, but it's so important to sit down with somebody who works on retirement planning, that this is what they do for a living for people. And I know you're going to talk about this in a moment, but you're going to invite people to call in an 800 number for the next five people who call in, who meet the requirements. I'll sit down with them personally, and I'll help them put together a real live, honest-to-God retirement plan, a retirement income plan that'll get them to the promised land.
So they won't have to rely on friends and family for advice?
And lawyers.
And lawyers. Bill Geiger, nice to see you again.
Good to see you, sir.
Now, if you're planning, or if you're in your late 50s or early 60s, this could be a confusing time for retirement planning. But if you're wondering how the election or global events and the current economy might affect your retirement, you're not alone. Bill Geiger from Geiger Wealth Management understands and has a tremendous opportunity for you today. He's going to sit down with you personally, just like you said, create a full-blown financial plan for your retirement. It's complimentary for the next five callers who have at least $500,000 saved for their retirement. So call him at 800-681-2498, and Bill will translate the complex financial planning process into easy-to-understand steps with the roadmap to help you get where you need to be and where you want to be. Call Geiger Wealth Management right now at 800-681-2498. That's 800-681-2498. One more time, the number is, you ready? 1-800-681-2498. Thank you very much, Kim Gordon. Steve Bertrand here. You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. And thank you for that. Hope you'll follow me on Twitter. I'm at Steve Bertrand, or Facebook, just Steve Bertrand, or Steve Bertrand Travel, or also just Steve Bertrand on books. By the way, Steve Bertrand Travel, you know, we had set up this trip to Ireland in October, and I keep getting calls and hearing from people, and I appreciate that. But that trip sold out in record time. So, We are chock full when it comes to the trip to Ireland in October. I appreciate your interest, but there's just not room this year. But we are adding a trip in April with some of the people who couldn't get on this year. We've got quite a list, but we're growing that and hope to have details on that coming up soon. So maybe if you couldn't go in October, you can in April. Elise Glink, when are you going to come to Ireland with me?
I love Ireland. Would be happy to go anytime.
It's interesting because it's just red hot this year. I mean, I've had a few groups go, and we have a hard time getting hotel space. I wonder if people are a little leery of going to the continent, and so they're either going to Ireland. I don't know.
I think that's a part of it. I also think Ireland offers a tremendous deal.
Yes, exactly.
You're just great value for the money.
Yeah, it is more affordable to go to Ireland than to a lot of spots on the continent. That's a good point. Okay, so how do we make money so that we can afford to take a trip overseas?
Well, you know, it's interesting. Companies are always calling me to talk about digital marketing strategies, and they want to do this and they want to do that. And the question that I always say to them, number one, is what are you trying to accomplish? And the second thing is, how do you plan to measure it? Because I think where it falls down is we're very quick sometimes to outlay the money for a digital marketing strategy and to find somebody to execute for it. And how do you actually value it and see if it's working and it actually pays for itself?
Well, you know, that's a good question. And I would imagine that my answer would be, well, if I get more play, more email, more contact versus or via Twitter and all of that. I mean, isn't that the sort of rational way you'd see whether or not things are working?
Absolutely. But there's some really more specific ways. Let's call it five things that I think you should probably specifically look at. And then within that, start to keep track on what happens. So we sometimes start to do these, but they don't. So the five areas that I think companies should be looking at are first search engine optimization. So
SEO, right?
SEO. How many people are finding your site, your company, your stores, your locations through organic search, meaning the information you're putting up, versus paid search, the ads that you place for it? And what does that referral traffic look like coming back to you? And how are your keyword rankings changing?
Okay, so the SEO, that's what when you're building your site or loading it, right, you put in you know, radio show, business lunch, things like that that you hope people will search for, that word will pop up, and then your site will appear, correct?
That's exactly right. And putting in regular fresh content to, you know, whether it's through a blog or you're adding different landing pages, information that has those keywords that are well placed, that's a really important piece of this. And a lot of times companies will get all excited about their blogs. They start putting information up. They're doing a great job. And then after month two or three, that ends because you get busy either with all the traffic you're getting or the customers that you're converting, and you don't get back to it, and then it falls off again. So staying on top of it, watching how it goes month in and month out is pretty important.
All right. What do you mean by keep track of the metrics that you're using?
Well, one of the things that you can do that would be super simple is to just open up an Excel, you know, file, or if you are using Google Docs, you can just open up one of their spreadsheets. And every month, you can track how many pieces of content you're putting up, how do you rank for search engine optimization, how many responses you're getting or how many new customers came through, let's say if you're doing an email marketing campaign. And you can track that month in and month out. Or if you have somebody who's handling marketing on your team, this is one of the things they should be doing for you.
Do you ever get frustrated in that marketing? It strikes me that if I'm running a pizza shop or whatever, that marketing is one of those things that I can also do. Oh, I can handle that. I can do. I know what needs to be done there. And clearly, the more we talk, the more it's clear I don't know what to do. And I would imagine most of us don't. We need experts like you. But it must be a little frustrating that, you know, you're looking at people who think they can do what you really know how to do.
Well, let's talk about, you know, your Ireland trip because you brought it up at the top of the segment, right? You have all these people who want to go to Ireland with you, and yet more are probably coming in or calling you. Keeping track of that, if you were a different kind of a business, right, you don't want to lose track of those people because those people represent future people on the trip, right? So finding a way to convert those people or to stay in touch with them. If you were running, let's say, a bakery and you were getting this kind of customer response and you want to tell them about new jelly donuts that are coming out, you want to make sure that you have a way to stay in touch. And so a lot of times companies will take these leads that come in and then they convert them into people who are part of an email marketing list, for
example. I see. Okay.
and they offer them free things in order to come back in and try those jelly donuts. So you want to find a way. This is where I think that marketing could really be effective, right, is getting to understand why people, you know, came to you in the first place, measuring how often they're coming back, and then finding ways to make them happy until you've got something that they want to buy.
So when people send me an email or drop me a line, I jot it down on a piece of paper. You're telling me that's not an effective way to do it?
Wait, do you put it in a shoebox? Because that's exactly how people keep their taxes.
No, it's not in a shoebox. It's on my desk at home somewhere. And I've got five or six different notepads. And, yeah, okay,
oh.
I see what you're saying.
So, well, it quickly outgrows. You know, if you're at all going to be successful in your company that's kind of a smaller, even a medium-sized business, and you're starting to grow, you can quickly outgrow the notepads. And that's how everybody starts, right? But once you get 10 or 15 or 20 leads on a notepad, or you start having several notepads because you forget it at home and now you got calls at work, that's when you outgrow that system. And so finding ways to keep a track of it in a digital way that's in the cloud that you can access wherever you are from your phone and you're constantly in touch with it, or your marketing person is, that's really how you start to convert things.
I was just going to say, you know, there's no way to put a notepad in the cloud. I've tried. It's not going to work.
Well, not a physical one, but there's definitely Evernote and some other tools.
You've mentioned the email marketing, and I'm interested in that too. I get so many emails that, you know, I delete 95% of my emails before I even open them. But I would imagine when you're talking about this conversion, take someone who's sent you something, indicated interest, how do you convert them to a customer? A lot of times that will rely on things like email marketing.
Right. Email marketing is here to stay. And companies that think that, you know, there's going to be something newer or better or fancier or whatever coming down the pike, I would argue that at the bottom line, email marketing is going to be there, and it's just you're going to add to it or subtract from it depending on how your business operates.
There's such a fine line between effective email marketing and sort of abuse or stalking.
Yes.
Or, you know, I mean, and that does damage to your business, I would imagine.
Well, every week, for example, I've been doing an email newsletter. I don't have anything to sell on my ThinkLink, which is all the real estate and personal finance information, but I have 10,000 people who over the years have followed my stuff or bought the books and wanted to stay connected. And so what I give them each week, what I think they want, is really helpful tips and advice for them making their best money moves. And so every week I write a whole bunch of things that are going on. Some usually it's timely, like right now we've been writing about tips for your new college-bound high school graduate. But those kinds of tips are things that I think people keep opening up. At least that's why the open rates are good. And you have to really have a benchmark, too, because what does it mean if 5% open your email list,
right,
or 20%? It depends on your industry.
Even if they're not opening it, I guess, if you're there in a steady way, and not an abusive way, when they are ready to open it, they know that you're going to be there and they can check it out then too.
Absolutely. There's another way to do this, which is to set up an email stream that goes for maybe 8, 10, 12 weeks that in itself teaches somebody, a potential customer, how to go from point A to point Z, for example, whatever it is that you're doing, and do it in a way that allows them to access that information when they hit the right point in the cycle. So I did this for a customer a long, long time ago, mortgage company, and they were interested in taking their existing pool of customers, people who already had mortgages with them, and if they went out to go and refinance, they wanted them to refinance with the company. So what I designed for them was an education-based email marketing campaign. So somebody would come to their website, they would opt in, and they would just, you know, when they opted in, they would start to get the emails that were relevant to their situation because they were in the mindset of searching around for something that was going to help them with the process. So if you are in a position like that, and you can let people opt in, and then you've got a set group of emails to send, that can be wildly successful.
Elise Klink, so much to learn. Thanks very much for joining us again today.
Happy to be here, Steve.
You bet. You're listening to The Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Thanks, very much, Orion Samuelson. Steve Bertrand here. You're listening to the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN from the Allstate Showcase Studio. Beautiful view along Michigan Avenue on this spectacular day in Chicago. No day to watch TV. Wait a minute. Carl Quintanilla is on the phone line from CNBC. Carl, welcome to the Business Lunch.
Hey, Steve. It's good to be with you.
I'm hearing a little echo. Can you deal with that?
Yeah, I'm okay if you are.
I'm good. All right. So, you know, it's amazing to me now how I watch TV. When I pick a program, I'm no longer picking a way to spend, you know, 30 minutes or an hour. I'm investing in, what, 8 or 9 hours, and I don't want to watch a show if I'm only going to watch it once.
We're definitely in an on-demand kind of economy, and it's touching everything, including the content that we watch. So binge-watching is now, 5 years ago, there was no such thing. There was no word for it, but now it's increasingly the way people are watching a show, not one episode at a time, but 5, 6. I think Netflix did a study once that the average is 5 or 6 in a row.
You forget about it, but the fact is that we used to watch shows, series that didn't necessarily have a story arc. And now I can't imagine, whether it's a sitcom or a dramedy or drama, a show that doesn't have a season-long arc.
Yeah, there's some, some procedurals are doing well. Chicago, Dick Wolf in the Law and Order franchise has found a spot where it draws an audience of people who simply want to sit down. They don't want to invest in a whole season-long arc. They just want to sit down and watch an hour of good TV. But I think the reason they're succeeding is because there are so few of those types of shows. Most of them are asking you to commit. And if you haven't started Game of Thrones, you've got a lot of work to do to catch up to where everybody else is.
You know, and so I'm excited about this series binge that you put together. I watched the teaser last night because, you know, I think of it from a viewer point of view. It has to have completely changed the way producers are creating their art.
That was our idea. Like, all right, as consumers, we get it. We know how we're watching television and movies. But think of, like, the creative types, the screenwriters, the producers, the showrunners, the studio chiefs. All these different decisions are being made from a business point of view, from an artistic point of view. Making a series that is intended to be binged is a lot different than the way showrunners did shows in the 70s and 80s where they had cliffhangers that lasted for months.
Who shot J.R., Carl?
Exactly. So, in fact, we talked to Brian Grazer, who did 24 years ago, and his point of view is that 24, you'd think it'd be bingeable, but part of what drove the conversation at 24 was having to wait for the next episode.
Right.
What's Jack Bauer going to – how's he going to get out of this one?
You know, you brought up Game of Thrones, and I was late to Game of Thrones, started watching it last year, and so I binged on Game of Thrones to catch up for the start of last year's season. Now that this year's season has started and I'm only watching it once a week, the feel isn't the same for me. I don't think I'm getting as much out of it.
Yeah, it is amazing that the phenomenon that it is. But, kudos to you for saying, I'm going to get up to speed on where everybody else is, because there's a point at which some of these shows, you literally can't escape the discussion about them. Right?
No, exactly.
Whether it was Breaking Bad.
Well, Breaking Bad.
Mad Men.
Yeah, I never watched Breaking Bad.
Right.
So I had to basically go to sleep for a week during that whole conclusion. Here's a quote from you. It says, it's probably the most exciting time in media since the mass adoption of TV, which is an interesting way to think of it. But when I think of that, I think that we're in a series of sort of trepidation right now, too. The companies in the media world aren't exactly sure how to respond to what's happening now.
I think that's definitely true. It's one thing to be a creative type with an idea for a show because you got a million more buyers for your product now. But, you look at like a company like Viacom or, Blockbuster had the chance to own half of Netflix at one point. And you just are seeing these giants, these conglomerates who are lions of the industry, and they've just had their lunch eaten,
right,
like in front of your eyes. We talked to Andy Cohen of Bravo, And we said, this must be a gold rush for programmers. And he said, it's the Wild West. I mean, it's people are a little more scared than they are excited about it.
Well, that's the thing, because anyone can do it. There's so many platforms, but you tend, I mean, the other side is that anyone can do it. You know, my Blockbuster is now a mattress store, Carl. Tell me, we got to go here, but the binging of binge starts, I think, on Sunday or Monday. How do people watch your program?
So it's on Hulu. It's on YouTube, CNBC.com. You'll see it on Apple TV, and it'll be out on social platforms like Twitter. But, yeah, 5 episodes that are intended to be binged with various guests, and we're just going to keep making more of them as we go forward. Very excited.
Excellent. Nice to talk to you. I hope we can do it again.
Thanks so much.
You bet. Carl Quintanilla from CNBC. This is the Business Lunch.